these committees, presumably in the Congress, will be thinking about separation of powers issues, anticipating what the court might be concerned with as those sort of other factors, and could be successful perhaps on a faster time frame, given that there now is some kind of a roadmap here. But I don't think it's going to be significant in the short term in terms of the Congress getting the accounting information and the tax information prior to November.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 10th, 2020. The Supreme Court, on the final day of its term yesterday, handed down the two big subpoena cases, Trump v. Vance, in which the president tried to beat back a subpoena from a New York grand jury, and Donald Trump v. Mazars USA LLP, in which the president tried to beat back a congressional subpoena for his financial records. He didn't entirely succeed in either case, but he made some headway in the Mazars case. We have got a bang-up crew to discuss it all in the virtual jungle studio. From Lawfare, Margaret Taylor, Scott Anderson, Quinta Jurassic, and Molly Reynolds are here to talk through it all. We'll talk about whether the president has a path forward before the New York grand jury, and we'll talk about what the cryptic decision in Mazars portends, both for Trump and for the executive-legislative oversight relationship. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 10th. The subpoena cases come down. Quinta, I want to start with you. Can you give us a quick summary of what the Supreme Court did today?
Sure. So both these cases involve subpoenas sent by an entity. In the Vance case, it is a New York State grand jury. In the Mazars case, it's various House committees for financial information related to Trump and or his businesses. And in both cases, Trump sued to essentially block those third parties from complying with the subpoenas. The Vance case, I think, is the more sort of sexy, exciting one based on how the court wrote it. It's also the simpler one. Essentially, what the court said was that Trump had asserted that he had a sort of temporary absolute presidential immunity to criminal process while in office, to the extent that he could not even be subject to a subpoena from a grand jury for information related to him. Remember, he's not actually the person being subpoenaed. The court slapped that down pretty resoundingly. There's actually, even though the vote was 7-2 with Justices Thomas and Alito dissenting, it's actually 9-0 if you look at the number of justices who agree that there is no absolute immunity to that kind of criminal process while in office. The Mazars case is a little more complicated. Essentially, the court said that Trump's arguments that Congress was not serving a legitimate legislative purpose, that it hadn't met a sort of a high standard of need to get the relevant information, was incorrect. But it also said that Congress and the lower courts hadn't really given adequate consideration to the fact that the separation of powers concerns implicated by the fact that it was the president's information that was being requested. And so the court, again, it's a 7-2 vote. The majority set out four different factors that it suggested the lower courts should take into consideration to weigh those separation of powers issues a little more carefully. And so in both cases, it's going to go back down to the lower courts. I think there's open questions as to what exactly will happen and on what timeline.
Margaret, I think the key question about Vance is whether there is any chance the Supreme Court would have spent as much time talking about the Burr treason trial if Hamilton were not so cool right now. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. I mean, it came out on television, so everyone's sitting around watching it. So, you know, Surely.
I mean, they were clearly like, we need a serious Burr section here, right?
That's right.
All right. So when the oral arguments happened, you were, as a devout congressionalist, feeling pretty down in the dumps about where this was headed. How bad was it from your point of view?
Well, to be clear, on the Vance case, I think people like me were sort of fairly upbeat on that one. That doesn't involve the congressional side. But on the congressional subpoena cases, yes. So listening to the oral argument in the Supreme Court, I mean, I thought it was going to be like a bloodbath for congressional power in the context of the separation of powers. I thought it was just going to be very bad. I mean, people will recall the oral argument where justices were using terms like presidential harassment and asking the people making the arguments before the court, you know, well, what is this presidential harassment, which just has never been a phrase that is used in this context. So it was not looking good. You know, when the opinion came out today, my general sense was that it wasn't exactly the bloodbath that I had expected. Which was good. That said, it does break new ground in terms of setting a kind of new set of considerations or a new kind of standard for congressional subpoenas and how they will be treated by the court. And in that sense, I do think the opinion chips away at what up until now, mostly everyone had thought of as Congress having a very broad, not unlimited, but sort of nearly unlimited scope in terms of what kind of information it could obtain through a valid legislative subpoena. So it's a bit mixed, not as bad as I thought it would be, but on the other hand, it does set a new standard for how these two branches of government, the legislative and the executive, are going to be working together or not going forward when it comes to requests for presidential information from the Congress.
So, Scott, walk us through exactly what the Supreme Court is requiring of Congress. This case goes up on the basis of an apparently valid congressional subpoena. The president says, no, it's not a valid subpoena because you don't have an appropriate legislative purpose. The legislature says, yes, we do. And the Supreme Court basically says, hey, lower courts, do over. I want you to think about separation of powers when you consider this subpoena. What exactly are they telling the lower courts to do? And do you think that is a standard that Congress can meet as a general matter?
Sure. You know, the thing to really bear in mind is that it put forward four factors, all of which relate to the separation of powers concerns that the appellate courts really didn't deal with kind of expressly. Both of them viewed this as a case where this request subpoenas going to a third party and therefore just doesn't raise the same level of separation of powers concerns, at least, than something that would go direct to the executive branch. The court instead said, no, this really does still implicate major separation of powers concerns. So it said, first, you need to look at the legislative purpose and warrants, specifically whether it warrants actually involving the president personally, basically whether there's a basis for actually believing the president's personal involvement or request specifically relating to him is necessary for that legislative purpose. For the same reason, that's kind of those are the two first two factors. First, whether it's really necessary for the legislative purpose, and then that the scope is appropriately tailored to that legislative purpose, essentially avoids any unnecessary intrusion into the operations of particularly the office of the president, but then the person of the president, because it acknowledges that the division between the office of the president and the president as an individual isn't entirely clear, particularly when it comes to burdens on the individual or office. The third is they really want you to look at the specific evidence offered by Congress about the legislative purpose. They essentially say you need to look at, see what Congress has done to indicate they actually are pursuing legislation, considering it, that is something that they are legitimately considering, so it's not pretext, essentially. And the fourth factor that it weighs in is the fact that what sort of burdens it imposed on the president by complying. In these cases, we heard the parties argue that, in fact, this was a third party, so it doesn't impose that much of a burden. We heard pushback from that, from Justice Breyer at oral argument from the House's attorney about that specific point, saying, no, this actually can burden the president because he's still aware this is happening. He may have to respond to it in different regards, and even if in his personal capacity. So it's not so easy to say that these aren't implicated here. But these are really just four kind of overlapping factors that it says expressly are non-exhaustive. What it's really doing is directing to the lower courts and saying, you need to think about this as a separation of powers issue. You can't just step around it or step over it by addressing the fact this is addressed towards a third party. Instead, you need to dig in and really think about, well, what sort of imposition is this putting on the executive branch, particularly on the president, and how warranted is it by Congress's legislative purpose? That said, you know, it does close on this kind of telling line, telling particularly in the emphasis, the italics it puts it in, where it says, when Congress seeks information needed for intelligent legislative action, it unquestionably remains the duty of all citizens, all being italicized, to cooperate. And so it's strongly implying that there are subpoenas along these lines the president has to comply with. They just need to be properly balanced to take into account the different separation of powers concerns and the concerns of both branches involved.
All right, Molly. So if you're now a congressional oversight committee and you get this decision, is your response to kind of throw up your hands and say, what's the point? You know, we do this a year, issue this subpoena a year plus ago, and we're not going to get this done in time for the election. What's the point? Or do you see it as a long-term battle between you and the executive in which this is a negotiating data point and this is the next opportunity that you have in order to play cards in your hand?
Yeah, so I think what's tricky from the perspective of congressional committees is that, as the court actually makes clear in the opinion, Congress and the executive branch have gotten to a point where the way that historically they were able to deal with conflicts over information requests from Congress of the executive branch is broken down entirely. The court discusses a fair amount the idea that Congress and the executive branch used to negotiate, they used to come to some sort of kind of mutual agreement, and that process of accommodation really has not worked in recent years. And so on one hand, if you're a congressional committee, you look at this decision, you say, okay, we've gotten to the point where we're not really getting any information from the executive branch without trying to litigate over it anyway. So having some direction from the court might be about how these kinds of disputes would play out in the future might be helpful. But on the flip side, I think you're also basically facing an executive branch that now has an even greater incentive to try and take all of these disputes to court, because the Supreme Court has now said, here are a set of criteria that courts are supposed to use. So why wouldn't the executive branch, which generally is not interested in handing over information to Congress, why wouldn't they simply litigate every one of these requests from Congress, force Congress to issue the subpoenas, force them to go to court, and then just try to run out the clock, as I think we are seeing in this case. Regardless of kind of what happens, I think, frankly, in either the Mazars piece or the Vance piece going forward, the chances that the information in question is actually obtained before the election is pretty small. And so we're now at a point where, you know, despite the fact that the Supreme Court has made much of this historic process of negotiation and sort of there's this sense that I get from the opinion that they want to seem reluctant to step into this dispute, but you know, Congress and the president are making them do that. They're now basically guaranteeing going forward more of these protracted litigation battles.
That's such an interesting point, because I think if we had John Roberts here, he would say, no, 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 Molly, I am trying to do exactly the opposite of that. For 200 plus years, Congress and the executive branch work these things out by themselves. And we've never, as a result, never had a case like this before. We don't want to be in this position. So instead of deciding it and rewarding either side, we're going to kind of decline to decide it, but kind of tea leave it and, you know, give some guidance without actually resolving it, and thereby incentivize the parties to return to the traditional way of doing this. So my question, and I'll leave this as a jump ball for whoever wants to get in on it, is Molly right that this is actually going to encourage litigation, or is my channeling of John Roberts right that this will discourage litigation because you can't get a resolution in a reasonable time frame, and therefore you should return to the traditional bargaining table?
So I'd love to hear what others think, but the one thing I'll say is that I think that in general, because the executive branch is less interested in complying with congressional requests for information, that unless Congress were to take other actions outside the scope of subpoenas, and we could talk about what those might be, but unless Congress were to sort of stand up for itself in other ways, I don't think the executive branch has a real incentive to go back to negotiating if what they want to do is keep the information for themselves, not give it to Congress, and the degree to which the court has set out a roadmap for adjudicating these disputes really, I think, gives them an incentive to keep trying to litigate. But others may disagree.
You know, I do think Molly makes a really important point, which is it's the executive branch that has the information, and it's the legislative branch that wants it. So they have an sort of asymmetric advantage there when you're talking about how long litigation takes.
No, but not here. Here it's Mazars and Deutsche Bank that have the information.
That's true. But what the court has done here is said, when you're talking about presidential information, the court is essentially going to treat it as a separation of powers issue. And so, you know, you're going to be, even though you're subpoenaing a private entity, you are, you know, the Congress is going to have to concern itself and be tied up in these larger questions of separation of powers, which we normally think of as applying when the subpoena goes to the executive branch. So the way I see it, the court is in a sense sort of collapsing the consideration of these types of questions, even though this subpoena didn't go to the executive branch. I mean, but what I would say is, you know, I do think there is a roadmap here. I think that Roberts and his colleagues in the majority opinion have laid out a way for congressional committees to successfully subpoena presidential information in the future. I agree with Molly. It's just the timeline here is not going to happen before the election. You know, in the long term, though, it may be the case that these committees and, you know, houses of Congress have trained themselves to comply with these four factors. And also, I should point out, and Scott mentioned this, you know, Roberts is specific that, you know, he says other considerations may be pertinent as well. One case every two centuries does not afford enough experience for an exhaustive list. So these committees, presumably in the Congress, will be thinking about separation of powers issues, anticipating what the court might be concerned with as those sort of other factors, and could be successful perhaps on a faster time frame, given that there now is some kind of a roadmap here. But I don't think it's going to be significant in the short term in terms of the Congress getting the accounting information or the tax information prior to November.
Quinto, what do you think? Who won this case?
It's a good question, and I've been actually going back and forth on it all morning, on all afternoon since the opinions came out. I mean, I do think that it is not a clear-cut win for Trump, and I think that there's certainly a sense in which, as we've discussed, you know, it does seem like the materials won't be available before the election. On the other hand, if you take a look at his Twitter feed, he is extremely unhappy with the results, and, you know, somehow has managed to connect this to the Russia investigation and all kinds of things that aren't really part of this question at all. So I think that where I ultimately come down is that I think it's murky, and it feels strange that it's murky precisely because Trump tried to frame it as a really bright line question, if that makes sense. I mean, to some extent, Congress did too, but I think it was Trump who was sort of really pushing the envelope on Mazars. And so we end up in this situation where this is something that we're clearly all going to be puzzling over for quite a while. And I think the institutional reverberations are going to be something that we're going to be watching play out for a long time, right? I mean, some of these are empirical questions, right? Like, will there be more litigation or won't there? But the sort of the Trump news cycle is such that there's, I certainly, as a journalist, have a desire to sort of jump in and say, you know, that it's clear one way or the other. And I think it's just muddy and we sort of have to let it be muddy. I mean, what does everyone else think? Am I sort of taking an off ramp there that I shouldn't be taking?
Yeah. Who won, guys?
So I would say, you know, I think we have to divide the Mazars case from Vance. I think Vance is a pretty clear win for Vance. The problem there is the outcome isn't the one that people were thinking about who weren't tracking this case very closely. People thought, oh, this means that tomorrow I get to see Trump's tax returns. And that's just was never the case with Vance. We heard the state of New York say it wasn't going to be the case. They said they're going to respect grand jury secrecy. They're going to keep it to themselves. They just want the access to these financial records for their own investigation, which they're now going to have. And that's pretty notable. That's a big win. And it can result with major consequences for the president, whether it's indictments, ongoing investigations, maybe before November, but more likely after November, but still, it's a pretty big consequence and a win for the rule of law in a lot of ways in terms of holding even the president accountable for his conduct when a private citizen or in his private capacity. Mazars is a little bit more mixed here. But again, going in here, there was really a genuine question as to whether we thought this was an area where the courts was going to let Congress do anything like this, request these sorts of subpoenas outside the context of impeachment, if you follow the kind of Rao Thomas line of thinking, or if you follow the Solicitor General's types arguments, only in cases that where there's the utmost specific demonstration of need, the type that normally can penetrate executive privilege in the kind of Nixon context. But instead, here, we see them saying, no, in fact, Congress can make these sorts of requests, and it's beholden upon all Americans to comply with them to some extent if they're properly balanced. Now, maybe that's going to be a complete red herring. It's possible the court's going to come back later and say, all those factors, you can never really reach these factors. This is an imaginary standard that is never actually going to be realized, and therefore nothing's ever going to be enforced against the president. But I think that's kind of hard for the court to do. It's laid out a roadmap here. It sent the matter back to the lower courts to look at. I don't think it's clear that certainly the HPSI request, and in some ways the oversight request at least, check a lot of the boxes that they kind of lay out, at least come close to it within realms of adjustment. And then really is going to be on the court to say, you know, are we going to stick by our precedent? And notably, they don't have to actively intervene. If the lower court comes in and says, no, in fact, we applied this court and we determined these can be enforceable, then, you know, the justices can simply decline to take cert and they don't actually have to directly involve themselves in the matter. So, you know, I think there's a chance here that Mazars has consequences and is in a lot of ways a long-term win for Congress, even if in the short term, Congress may not get its immediate and most desirable goal of having these tax returns out before November.
Margaret, you started today by saying not a bloodbath or not quite the bloodbath you were expecting. Is not a bloodbath a win, or is this, or would you say this is like Congress has lost less ground here than you expected?
It's the latter. It's that they've lost less ground than I had expected. And just to take a little bit of an issue with Scott's characterization of you know, sort of going into this, I just want to remind listeners that all of the lower court opinions in the Mazars case, in the Deutsche Bank and Citibank cases up in the Southern District and the Second Circuit, they all went one way, which was Congress's power is super broad. They've made a sufficient showing of a valid legislative purpose here. And the courts, all the lower courts said, we see a valid legislative purpose here. We're not going to get into it any further because that's not our role. And we're going to defer to the congressional subpoena and it's valid. So that's how all of the lower courts in these cases were decided. It was really the oral argument in the Supreme Court, which, you know, got everybody sort of like, oh, gee, this doesn't seem to be going the way of the lower courts. And that's what really awakened this sort of fear about, gee, the Supreme Court looks like it's going to set a whole new standard, a whole new bar for congressional subpoenas. And after the decision, we're going to think about them differently. And that is what happened. The Supreme Court said courts are going to look very specifically into the justifications of the legislative purpose for a subpoena. It's, you know, the more specific, the better is what this opinion says. And so it is an erosion of what we had thought of as Congress's broad power. But on the other hand, it is the first time the Supreme Court is really considering one of these congressional subpoena cases. And it is thankfully saying, yes, it is possible to have a valid congressional subpoena. And here are the factors you need to think about when you do it. So at least the Supreme Court didn't sort of eviscerate congressional subpoena power. I mean, that was a concern among people in sort of my circles that was the bloodbath that people had been fearing. Not with certainty, but with trepidation.
What do you think, Molly? Who won this case?
Yeah, I think I largely agree with Margaret that basically, like, there is a universe in which this could have come out much worse for Congress than it did, where Congress's subpoena power could have been weakened much more than it was. I think as a practical matter, a lot of the kind of medium to long-term consequences of this will involve something Margaret brought up before about kind of how does Congress start to approach the task of routinely litigating some of these questions. I mean, as I said before, I fully expect that, you know, we're going to see even more litigation over congressional subpoenas going forward. I'd love to be wrong about that, but my instinct is that that's where we'd be going. And so, does Congress really develop an ability to litigate those cases well and quickly? I think will matter a lot for individual oversight requests going forward. Again, I think that there is a universe that could have been much worse. There's a mention in by Thomas in his dissent where, you know, he would have held that Congress has no power to issue a legislative subpoena for any private or non-official document. So, you know, there is a world where Congress's power would have been diminished even greater than it was. But I do think that there are real limits being placed on Congress now that weren't there before this opinion.
All right, I want to stand up for Scott and not just to make this a 2-2 vote.
What am I, a chop
Quinta?
Liver?
Quinta will have no, to be the deciding
Quinta's
vote.
Abstained. So but you guys were ahead 2-1.
And I think if I have to pick, I side with Molly and Margaret. Well, let's have a gender debate. Oh,
well, you know, that's... You know, when you were asked, and you were the first one asked who won, you said you didn't know. I think you've got to run with that. But look, I want to stick up for Scott, because I actually think, in addition to now you're making this a gender divide thing. So, you know, the male side, which is Congress won, has to stick together here. But jokes aside, I actually think there's something to be said for the idea that Congress won a lot here. I agree with Margaret that the baseline was Congress can, within reason, get anything it wants. But the important caveat to that baseline is that the Supreme Court has always avoided resolving presidential subpoena cases when it possibly can. And so this is a matter of first impression in that regard. And unlike the Nixon tapes case, these are not executive branch documents. They're personal documents. And that point is really an issue of first impression. And so what did Congress lose here? It lost the ability to treat the president just like any other person. But what are the conditions that are imposed? Well, it has to have a legitimate legislative purpose. Presumably, it can satisfy that. There has to be a proximate relationship between what it's asking for and the legitimate legislative purpose. It can't simply use the president as a case study for something. it has to be asking for the president's records for a discernible reason related to its legitimate legislative purpose. And I look at the Intelligence Committee subpoena and I say, okay, they have been investigating Russian interference in the 2016 election for literally 4 years now. And they are thinking about remedial legislation in connection with that. And they're interested in connection with that in Russian money laundering and engagement with Trump hotel and real estate properties by Russian oligarchs. And they are thinking about Russian money and its interactions with the presidency. And so I say, first of all, obvious legitimate legislative interest, controlling the influence of Russian oligarch money in presidential elections. It's based on a long stream of investigative activity by the committee. It is not simply using the president as a case study. It is interested in the president and his business's real estate transactions for reasons that are immediately related to issues that it has been investigating for some time. And I look at it and I say, why should the House Intelligence Committee have any trouble meeting these guidelines that the Supreme Court has laid out? And so I want to say, for the purposes of the legitimate reasons, the non-fishing expedition legitimate reasons that Congress would seek to investigate Donald Trump's finances and tax returns and whatnot, I don't see a big problem under this opinion with getting what Congress wants. And I look at that and say, that seems to me like a win. So I'm just going to throw that out there and say, who wants to argue that the Intelligence Committee doesn't get what it needs?
So I wouldn't argue that. I think my argument would be that what about a case where it's less clear-cut and or a case where it's not clear unless Congress gets the information it's looking for exactly what the shape of legislation would look like. I guess as a sort of someone who's strongly biased towards the first branch, I think Margaret and I share this, that the idea that Congress is being set up to have to justify itself to the court, I think is part of what makes me think that this is not a great outcome for Congress going forward.
What do you think, Scott? Am I having outflanked you? Have I made you uncomfortable?
I don't know about that. I think the HPSI subpoena is a chance where it checks a lot of the boxes that the court has laid out here. That's going to be, I think, the best test case to say, okay, when this goes back down, they're going to amend it and tweak it potentially a little bit. They're going to flesh out their record for the factors the court's identified, and then the appellate court's going to look at it and it's either going to go back up. I'm sure Trump and his lawyers will appeal again and either be granted cert in the Supreme Court to look again or will be denied cert. You know, and we'll have to see where that eventually comes out. But I think the HPSI is the tip of the spear. That's a good test case to evaluate how big of a win or loss this is. And that hinges a lot on how seriously you take the court at its word here. You know, the one thing I would say in my defense, I guess, as the person on the downside of this is that, you know, any sort of win or loss depends on your baseline. But if your baseline here really was the idea that Congress was going to readily be able to step in and enforce these things on a super timely basis, I just don't know how realistic that was, even certainly after the oral argument, even at the appellate court level. I know the opinions went that way. That's absolutely correct. But we, you know, also know that the appellate courts are not the Supreme Court, not this Supreme Court. Maybe an idealized Supreme Court would rule differently. This is not the way I would, if I were the Supreme Court, approach these issues in their entirety. But for this Supreme Court, I think it's pretty telling that, you know, we didn't have any concurrences from liberal justices trying to blaze a trail and say, no, in fact, there is a lower standard that should apply here. Instead, we saw an effort to say we can all get on board with this sort of standard in the current state of affairs, with seven justices, with Kavanaugh and Gorsuch on board, which I do think is a real blow to the president that we haven't talked about yet. And again, weighs increases the reality of the threat of this sort of holding. You know, again, it in terms of realistically what I expected, this is a little bit better than I expected. And so for that reason, I still see it as a win.
Yeah. So let's talk about the politics on the Supreme Court. Quinta, it is a significant accomplishment, I think, institutionally on the part of the court to have a 7-justice majority on the basic holding. Now, they don't entirely agree about the rationale, but there's 7 justices for a wide degree of common ground here. 5 of those justices, including the chief, are on board for the whole opinion. And those include all 4 of the liberals. And so my question to you is, to what extent do you think the liberals are playing politics here and giving the chief his majority so that they can kind of hold on to this majority as cases like this or this case move forward? And to what extent do you think there really are 5 justices who agree on this in its entirety and 2 more who kind of mostly agree?
Well, so just to be clear, there's concurring opinions from Gorsuch and Kavanaugh in the Vance case, along with 5 in the majority, so the liberal bloc and the chief. And in Mazars, all 7 justices in the majority just voted with the chief. There are no concurring opinions.
Sorry, got my cases confused for a moment.
I've been getting them mixed up all day. I do think that it is, the politics are notable, right? And I think it's particularly significant, as Scott says, that both of President Trump's appointees voted with the majority, concurring or not, in both cases, and that the vote came out 7-2 in both cases. So a couple of things. One, it does make me wonder, to go back to Scott's point, to what extent different justices in what we can call as a shorthand the liberal bloc agreed wholeheartedly with the chief's opinion in Mazars, and to what extent they kind of just didn't want to rock the boat too much. And as you say, Ben, felt that it was really important that there be an overwhelming majority on this holding, given the political sensitivity of the case. I think it's an interesting question. I don't know if there's really any way to know, but it certainly shapes my understanding of the opinion. I will also say, on Vance, I was struck that the majority opinion goes out of its way to basically point out that the majority is pretty much in agreement with Justice Alito's dissent on many points. So it sort of seems like the majority is trying to say, okay, this is 7-2, but really in some sense, you know, in one sense, it's 9-0, right? That there is no temporary absolute immunity from criminal process. But in another sense, that it is 8-1 on the specifics of certain aspects of the holding, on the specific way that the justices would have sent it back to the lower courts. So there's really clearly an effort to make a show of unity on the part of the Chief Justice and on the majority voting with him.
And actually on the part of Justice Kavanaugh as well, who, you know, who begins his concurrence, and this time I have my cases right, who begins his concurrence by saying, hey, we all agree that there's no categorical immunity, and we all agree that this should be remanded to the district court in the first instance for the president to make whatever additional arguments he wants. You know, it is true that in the Vance case, the distance between the majority, the concurrence, and the dissenters is really, really constrained. On the other hand, in Mazars, the distinction between the majority and the dissent is not constrained. As Molly rightly points out, Justice Thomas takes the position that not only is there no legislative subpoena available for the president's personal papers, there's no legislative subpoena available for anybody's personal records. And so I think you have a much wider gap, but I agree, Quinta, the core of the court is 7 justices. It's much more solid. What do you think, Scott, Are the liberals playing politics here and kind of lining up behind the chief, but they actually believe something closer to what Margaret believes, or are they, or should we understand there to be a solid seven here?
You know, I don't think it's so clear that they are all strictly playing politics. In oral argument, again, we heard Justice Breyer, and I believe Justice Kagan, although I'm less confident about that, really step in and question the House pretty aggressively on the limits of their subpoena power in this context, evoking a lot of the separation of powers concerns we see here. Justice Breyer in particular really pushed back on the idea that the fact that these requests are going to a third party doesn't implicate the president or separation of powers concerns, which was a big factor in the lower court's decisions, both in the D.C. Circuit and in the Second Circuit. He basically rejected that and said, of course, this relates to the president. Of course, it affects the separation of powers, even if somewhat indirectly. And so, you know, it's not clear to me that they don't, several of them, at least those two, don't buy into this to some substantial extent to say that there are separation of powers concerns raised here that the lower courts could have or should have addressed a little bit better. Now, does that mean that they might not have been willing to go along with an opinion that would have found them an adequate basis for addressing them in the existing record and found some other ways to affirm or found other ways to address them? That's possible. But it's not clear to me that the degree of compromise that it took to release, to reach this opinion was entirely a product of just politics, of a desire to horse trade away their actual views to the chief in exchange for a little moderation of his views just to get this more unanimity. Instead, I think some of them actually agreed with aspects of it. And of course, there is some element inevitably in reaching any opinion of compromise. And as the justices or judges of lower courts come together to come to one opinion that all of them can sign on to. So, you know, it's again, I think it's a little more complicated picture than simple horse trading that some people seem to be interpreting it as.
Yeah, I on your point about Justice Breyer, and it's hard to know with Justice Kagan, she wasn't on the court at the time, but, you know, Justice Breyer was on the court at the time of Clinton v. Jones. And if memory serves, he's the only justice to write a concurrence that was very sensitive to the president's concerns about, in the Jones case, about being distracted. A concurrence, by the way, that looks quite good in light of subsequent events. And so I think you can see a through line of consistency in Justice Breyer's approach here. He's sensitive to Clinton's concerns about litigation and distraction, and he's sensitive to Trump's concerns about litigation and potential distraction. That said, the N here is so small that it's hard to know. Margaret, what do you think? How do you understand the liberal votes behind Roberts here?
I never meant to imply that I didn't think the approach was a principled approach. I do think it is a principled approach, and it's a valid one. And in that sense, I don't have any reason to necessarily think that the liberal justices were like pulling their punches here. I mean, you can easily imagine them thinking, I mean, if you're just thinking about politics, you can think about the shoe being on the other foot and there being, you know, a Democratic president and a Republican House, which, you know, was the situation with the Benghazi hearings. And so I don't mean to imply it's not a principled approach, but where they landed is one that, as I said before, erodes congressional power. The one thing I will say about the opinion is it struck me that it's actually quite short. It seemed the majority opinion is quite short comparatively to some of these opinions can go on for forever. And that says to me that in the process of negotiating, they were saying, okay, well, we can't all agree on this, but we can all agree on these simple sentences. It is a fairly short and I would say simple ish opinion comparatively to some Supreme Court opinions that you read. So it does seem like that there was a lot of negotiation around the language. That's how I sort of read this. And they distilled this down to something that everybody could live with and that was a reasonable approach that met the needs of this sort of diverse group of people in the opinion. But you know, I do think it was at the expense of Congress's power.
Yeah, and I think that the line that someone quoted it earlier, it might have been Scott, on the fact that, quote, other considerations may be pertinent as well. So there's this whole, this question of, you know, we lay out four parts for what the court should do going forward, but then also, you know, other things could be relevant as well. So there is this big, for me at least, this big question of, you know, what else might those things be? And is that part, leaving that open, is that also part of kind of what happened here as they were trying to come to consensus around the opinion?
Well, I would just say if negotiation over opinions causes them to be shorter, more clipped, and less inclined toward flights of fancy or long historical digressions, I say bravo negotiation and compromise between justices, because I thought the opinion was delightfully short and got to the point, and I really did not miss any of the excess verbiage. We need to wrap up, but I want to ask you each before we go quickly where you think this is going next. Quinta.
Well, first off, I want to eat a little bit of crow. I said that the majority and Vance had noted that Justice Alito's dissent was closer to the majority than it might appear. It was actually Justice Thomas's dissent. So I think listeners can take this as a sign that there is a lot going on and many different moving pieces.
We've all read them quickly, and we're all mashing together two cases and multiple opinions within the cases.
Exactly. That being said, I think it will be interesting to see how quickly this moves. There's been a lot of debate on social media among former prosecutors about how quickly or slowly the Manhattan District Attorney might move in that case. I'll be interested to know Molly and Margaret's opinions on what Congress's litigation or lack thereof strategy might be following these cases. But for me, the real bottom line is that, you know, as we've said, I don't think we're going to see any of this material before the election. Frankly, I was with Scott. I never really thought that there was much of a chance of that to begin with. So it doesn't feel like a deficit. But to the extent that, you know, the Biden campaign was ready to push the button and send out some devastating ads in Iowa about the president's financial documents, they may have to hold off for now.
Molly, what are you looking for going forward?
Yeah, I think for me, the big question is, as Quinta kind of suggested, is what exactly does the House do next? Maybe less so in these specific cases. I suspect that, you know, there will be additional argument and litigation. The relevant House committees, if they see this information, won't see it before the election. But moving forward, thinking about what does it mean for Congress to develop for itself a capacity to litigate these kind of cases going forward? What does that mean about having to invest in its own legal resources and preparing, again, I think, for more frequent litigation moving forward?
Scott?
Yeah, I'll focus just on Mazars, as I think Quinta covered Vance pretty well, which is where the ball goes next. But for Mazars, you know, I think it's an interesting question. I don't think the House is going to let these inquiries go. So it kind of comes down to what happens in the election and what the next Congress decides to do. Assuming the House stays in Democratic hands, I think you'll see them renew or reissue similar subpoenas in the next Congress. And then the question becomes, well, if the president is reelected, then do we see these questions actually bear out? Right now, that's not looking super likely, although no don't want to jinx anything one way or the other. But if the president isn't reelected, which seems a little more likely right now, then all of a sudden, a lot of these separation of powers inquiries go away. So you may see a victory in response to the subpoenas, see them enforced, but without a final resolution about these broader separation of powers questions in this specific context raised by this case. So, you know, leaving us all kind of hanging on that front until the next time this unique fat pack pattern arises.
Margaret Taylor, you get the final word.
Well, so I'm unclear on what exactly we will see going forward. I think As a congressional institutionalist, what I'd like to see is the congressional committees pursue vigorously a victory, and a victory in the sense of prevailing in these cases. So these cases are going to be remanded. The lower courts are now going to sort of look at these factors and you know, look at the record and maybe some new information will be introduced into the record in these cases, I would hope to see Congress really pursue victories, meeting all of these standards, doing it as quickly as possible in order to, even if it's not before the election, if it's after the election, you know, whatever, but just vindicating for itself a Supreme Court victory or a victory that is at least sort of blessed by Supreme Court factors, but awarded by a lower court. So I would like to see institutionally Congress really be aggressive, continue to be aggressive here, and get a solid victory for itself based on these four considerations that Roberts and the majority opinion has laid out.
I could not agree more with that as somebody who is probably closer to an executivist than a congressionalist. I think it's really important that what the Supreme Court has basically said here is the president doesn't have absolute immunity. We shouldn't treat this stuff like executive privilege protected material. But when you're dealing with the president, Congress really needs to dot its I's and cross its T's and show that it's sensitive to these genuine separation of powers issues. And for Congress to turn around and do that and get that subpoena upheld would turn, to whatever extent Margaret is right and this is a defeat for Congress, snatch a victory from the jaws of defeat. And I think that would be a very salutary development here. But we are going to have to leave it there. Margaret, Molly, Scott, Quinta, thank you all for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer extraordinaire this episode was Zachary Frank of the Goat Rodeo firm. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Tweet us, share us on Facebook, pin us on Pinterest, upvote us on Reddit. You know, do dance videos with us on TikTok. You could get Lawfare merch at thelawfarestore.com. I bet you don't yet have those tumblers, the whiskey tumblers, the corkscrews, the socks. You know you need the socks. You also need to rate and review the Lawfare Podcast wherever you found us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by the one, the only Jen Patya Howell. Our music is by this week's Lawfare podcast guest, Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.